Okay, it's my pleasure to welcome Art to this. As you've already seen, he's someone who is always on the move. And I was trying to think, Art, when the first time I met you was. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the first time I met you was on a ski lift in Norway. On a conference. Art has had a very mobile life in terms of crossing country borders and subject borders. So I'd say he's an international and an interdisciplinary scientist. So he was born in the Netherlands, but brought up in Gabon. And he did his PhD in the Netherlands. And he's also worked in America. He's currently, as you can see from his slide, in Oxford in the physics department. But he's also worked in Cambridge in the chemistry department. So his research spans physics, chemistry, biology, and a bunch of other things, probably. This evening, he's here to talk to us not just about his scientific research, but also about how that affects his faith. And he's going to give us some insights into questions about that, because he has a Christian faith. And I have had the privilege of bumping into Ard in scientific contexts, but also contexts like this, involving Christians in Science. Ard is the International Secretary for Christians in Science National, and he's also an Associate Fellow at the Faraday Institute, which is an institute for science and Christianity. The title of his talk this evening is Self-Assembly. And evolution, models, metaphors, and meanings. So, if you're ready.
Yeah, you're ready, great.
Thank you.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm sorry I'm a bit late. I had another talk, actually, on evolution in my department that ran over a little bit. And then somebody pulled the emergency brake on the train just before Swindon. Oh. And then my taxi couldn't find the church. So. Anyway, I'm here. So what I wanted to tell you about was some ideas about evolution broadly, but more specifically looking at self-assembly, evolution, models, metaphors, and meaning. So the big picture is more something along these lines. I think that Christians particularly often have difficulty with evolution and thinking about science, and my argument will be to mainly that a lot of that has to do with we could use a cross-cultural metaphor to think about that. I tend to like cross-cultural metaphors, we all are familiar with the differences between cultures that have to do with words, traditions, and customs that are things that are on the surface. To give you an example, when I first came to the UK, I had been previously to that in the US, which were, as I picked up a lot of my English, and among the other things I learned there was that these things were called pants. Okay. So I, when I was in Cambridge, I thought, why not to wear something a bit more smart, so I went into a shop to get a jacket. A friend of mine, I got a jacket, and I said to the young lady, you know, do you have some pants to go with this? And my friend who was with me, you know, yelled, he means trousers. He then sat me down and went through some vocabulary lessons. So I had even more questionable tutorial taste than I do now, and I was used to wear braces, but Americans call those things suspenders. So those are superficial differences. One of the first jobs I was given when I got to Cambridge was to be in charge of the theoretical chemistry seminar series. And you know, and if you're probably the same as here, you have terms, and the talks are in terms. And one of my speakers at the last minute said he couldn't come, and could he come 1 week later, which is week 9, there are only 8 weeks in terms. So I said, oh, that's fine, put you in week 9, we'll all be more relaxed, then we'll be done teaching, and it should be fine. And one of my older, more distinguished colleagues walked up to me, and he said, I see, you've put a talk in week 9. I said, yes, I have. He said, we've never done that before. Hmm. And he smiled at me, and he walked away. And my Dutch nature wanted to argue back with him and say, well, you know, let me tell you why we did it for the following reasons. And I somehow thought I probably shouldn't. And then just as he turned the corner, the penny dropped. He was saying to me, don't ever do that again. That's a cultural difference in the way, particularly all the generation of distinguished gentlemen communicate in this country. And I had to learn those kinds of things. So the story is, if you have those kinds of cross-cultural differences, if you don't realize that they're there, it can be very, you can misunderstand a lot of what's going on, misunderstand of how things work. And so the main point I'm going to talk about today is that that is indeed the case, I think, very often with questions about evolution. And so what I'm going to focus on today are some metaphors, some ways of thinking about evolution, and questions about what that may or may not mean. So the first thing I want to show you is this little movie, which is a movie made by Keiji Namba's group in Osaka. That's a bacteria you just saw that's been zoomed in. It's an animation, so it's not the real thing, but it's his idea of how the bacterial flagellar motor works. So the bacterial flagellar motor, which you can see assembling right there, is a little motor that spins at 100,000 RPM, can stop in a quarter of a turn. It's an amazing piece of nanomachinery. And you can ask lots of interesting questions. I have a colleague in Oxford, Richard Berry, who measures the torque of these things. He sticks bacteria down onto little plates and measures how hard they turn. So that's one thing you could do with them. What I think is really fascinating about this is the following. If I were to find a little motor like that outside, in some reasonably macroscopic size, I would assume that it was made in a factory somewhere. Some very complicated structure, complicated assembly line, put it together. But these things make themselves. And in fact, if you think about it, your whole body is full of things that make themselves. There is no big factory that makes the things that you have in you, after you're born anyway. These things make themselves, and it's really astounding, it's amazing. So this movie is in fact what got me interested a number of years ago in working on cell assembly, which is one of the main topics of my group's research these days. Because I looked at that and I thought, well, how does that work? How on earth, how do they know, those proteins know where to go? Who tells them where to go? It's really actually quite amazing. In fact, if you want to think about it, you may not realize that you have more bacteria in your body than you have cells in your body by about a factor of 10, 10 to the 14 bacteria, 10 to the 13 cells. Before you all rush off to the hospital, that's perfectly normal, because bacteria are much smaller than your cells, they live in your gut, they do lots of good things. If we took them out of you, you'd be ill. In fact, probably also be very ill. So humans are part microbe. We talk about the human genome, but we should really talk about the microbiome, which is the microbes that are in your body that make you who you are. So while I'm speaking, some bacteria in your body will be making these little motors. It takes about 20 minutes, 30 minutes, typically, to make one of those. So this will be happening millions and millions of times inside of you while I speak. Something to think about while you're, if you get bored. So for a physicist, the problem with that bacterial flagellar motor is that it's too complicated. There are too many different kinds of parts. There are lots of different kinds of flagellar motors around in different versions. And so it's hard to know what you could really do that would be generic. And also there's experimental aspects that we simply don't know. The simpler set of organisms that you may also be very familiar with, which are also hanging around your body at this time, which are called viruses. Viruses are really simple objects. They're just shells made of protein with something like DNA or RNA inside. They come into your body, they hijack your cells, they inject their DNA or RNA into your cells, and your cells has a whole bunch of machinery to make copies of the virus. So the virus needs you to, or needs an organism to make copies of itself. Essentially, all it is a little ball with something with DNA or RNA inside. About half of the viruses on Earth are icosahedral viruses. They're almost spherical. And they have all kinds of interesting packings. Like this one right here is made of 12 pentagons of 5 particles each, proteins. 5 proteins each. So this was made of 60 individual proteins. Right, this one's 12 pentagons and 20 hexagons. If you look at an old-fashioned football, you'll see that they're stitched together exactly the same way as these guys are. So nature got there first. Now what's fascinating about viruses is that you can take some of these and take the DNA out, so all you have is a little shell. Let's say I take 100 of these ones with 12 pentagons, so 12 times 5, 60 each. I put 100 of them in the test tube. I have 6,000 individual identical copies of the proteins that are in 100 balls. I can change, in some cases, the solution conditions just slightly, and they'll dissolve into 6,000 individual proteins floating around. If I then change conditions back, they'll reversibly pop right back into 100 little balls. Which is like the bacterial flagellar motor, but somewhat simpler. There's only one type of particle and it all sticks together. So I think that's really interesting. It's something I'm working on in my lab, and this is a paper we just published last year. So I'm a theorist, so I work on theories of viruses. And these are actually on the computer, so they're computer viruses. But I tell my IT people that these are the good kind of viruses, not the bad kind. And so if we've designed these particles right, in this case these are pentagons, 12 of them should make a little virus, and if you design them right and you have to move around randomly, so you put them in your computer box, you turn on a random algorithm that has them move around randomly, and they'll spontaneously form these icosahedral 12 mers, these virus particles. So in this case we've succeeded in these on the computer and figuring out something about how these things might assemble. So I like to say this is a little bit like the following. It's like taking Lego blocks, putting them in a box, shaking the box, and out comes a fully formed train. That's essentially what's happening in nature all the time. It's something really spectacular and beautiful, I think. And so what I'd like to do is understand how that works. And when I write these days when you're a scientist and you write grant proposals, you have to always put in quite a long section about how it will be useful for society and how you might make money off of it. So sometimes I haven't yet done it, but I've been tempted to say, well, I'll make toys. I'd make lots of money. So that's the first kind of thing we're looking at. Science is something in science self-assembly. I think science is fun. I hope you can see this is something fun. And I pinch myself sometimes that I'm paid money to do this. In fact, for some of you, it's your tax money that's paying for me. Thank you very much. But there's a reason for this. We think that a lot of the best science comes out of curiosity-driven research, by people thinking, well, what is this going to be useful for? I spoke to Charlie Towns, who's the inventor of the laser, also a Christian scientist, Nobel Prize winner. And he said when he first worked on laser, they didn't really know that it was going to have any kinds of application. They just thought it was a fun thing to think about. And obviously, it's had a dramatic impact. So there is some reason for that. Now, 100 years ago or so, I would not have been able to be a scientist, because to be a scientist, you had to be a man, usually, of independent means. But today, there's a class of us that get paid by tax money, so thank you. Say that. So thanks for that. In any case. Great. So the first thing I told you was a little outline, self-assembly, how things make themselves. I wanted to say something about the Bible, nature, and science. Now, I've just got a new PowerPoint version on my computer, and for some reason that I don't quite understand, it doesn't let me see all the slides at once. So let me just see what I've done. Just give me just 1 second and then I'll sort this out. Strangely, this is the third talk I've given today, and the other two were fine. And this one decided that it wants to do something. So, in fact, normally when I give these talks, I do a much longer section on what does the Bible say about nature, because I think that's, for Christians, really where we should start, and really important. But that's not the topic of today. I also see we have Ernst Lucas in the audience, who will probably tell you a lot better, more clearly than I did, since I took a lot of things from his book. So there's a few things the Bible says about nature which are important. And the first theme that you see is that God sustains the universe. And so one of the really important things for Christians when they think about nature is to ask themselves questions about the language of God's actions. And there's a pretty long tradition of Christians thinking about this. And one of the kind of themes that comes out of that is the idea that if there is a God who is a faithful God who sustains the world, we would expect that the customs of the Creator, the ordinary way that God sustains the world, would be somehow regular. And if they're regular, therefore we might expect them to be uniform, which means if I do an experiment in Oxford, then under the same conditions, somebody in Cambridge, if they're smart, should get the same results, because the nature is uniform. And those are all kinds of, the whole series of metaphysical assumptions that we assume are true, and we need to assume are true in order to do science, but that science itself can't prove or disprove directly. And historically, There's a strong case to be made that it was reflections on God's action and reflection on God as a faithful sustainer of the world that had a big impact on the growth of early science. In fact, there's my colleague Peter Harrison has a very interesting thesis on the tremendous importance of the Protestant Reformation on modern experimental science. The idea that precisely because we're fallen, we can't just sit around in our armchairs and think about how nature should be. We have to go out and test it and look at it and see what it says. And I think there's a good argument to say that that the Protestant Reformation, with its emphasis on reading scripture directly, had a big impact on modern science. So the other thing we see is that God created the universe. People always ask me at the end, what do I think about Genesis 1 to 3? Doesn't that tell us that the earth is 10,000 years old, etc., etc.? I don't think that is the case. I won't give you a lot of details about why. And presumably you've had talks on this in the past. So those are the things, the caveats I'd say about the Bible, nature, and science. What I will talk a little bit more about is the question of what can nature say about God. As again, it's a ground-clearing exercise before I talk in more detail about how Christians might look at something like evolution. So the question about what nature can say about God is a complex one with an interesting history. One of the things that we see in the Bible is that God reveals himself through nature. So we see in Romans 1 that in the end, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, the eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. And in my experience of speaking on this topic, I know that probably, this is, if you're a typical audience, there'll be a number of people for whom this verse essentially means modern science should therefore tell us something about God. Because surely as we understand more and more about nature with our scientific methods, we should therefore understand more and more about what God's revealing us in nature. I'm not sure that's actually the right interpretation of this verse. So James Barr has a nice book on natural theology where he points out that this verse is really looking at things that should be obvious to everyone. Right? These were written in a pre-scientific age for a non-scientific people, smart people, but not people that would use science. And so therefore those qualities of God that could be grasped would be qualities that would be should be accessible to everyone in one way or the other. And the second point I think is important is that we often impose on these verses a kind of idea that these are this is about proving that God exists. But to a large extent, to the righteous in biblical times, the question about atheism wasn't the dominant thing they were thinking about. There was an assumption that people assumed that God did exist, and the question really was, could you see something about God by looking at nature? I grew up in Gabon in Central Africa, and I'd say that there, the vast majority of people, the idea that there is no God is not something that's really on their radar. Everyone assumes that there is a God. The issue is more that nature is magical, nature is deified, and so I think that context is actually much closer to the context when Paul was writing Romans. And to them, what this verse would basically mean is when you can look at nature, it tells you something about who God is, something about his greatness, his majesty. But it's not really a verse telling you that God doesn't exist. The reason why I'm harping on this a little bit is that my experience talking on science and faith issues is that for some people, there's a sense in which we should be able to look at nature and prove that God exists, because that's an issue which is very live today. And that may or may not be true. There's just not a lot of scriptural... that's not something that I think... That question is not something that scripture gives a lot of says a lot about, whether for or against. So what are some examples of God revealing himself through nature? Well, there's many beautiful examples. The Psalms particularly write about the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hand, day after day they pour forth speech, night after night they display knowledge. In Psalms 8, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the sun, the moon and the stars that you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, the son of man that you care for him? That's a very, I think, natural and correct impression you get as a Middle Eastern monarch, in this case, several thousand years ago, looking up at the sky. I think on a clear sky at night, you would really there's something majestic about looking at the stars. Today, of course, with our microscopes, we can see a lot more than just the visible ones. This is our Milky Way, and we're about here, in the edge of the spiral, or from the side, we're about here, a little solar system in a giant Milky Way. Milky Way has on the order of 100 billion stars, and there's an estimate there are on the order of 100 billion galaxies in our universe. So that's a lot of stars. And it's an interesting that in the Genesis passage, in a kind of throwaway line, he says he also made the stars. So what I do think is true is that what science allows us to do, both through our microscopes and through our telescopes, is to get an enhanced idea, enhanced view of just how glorious the world is and how much that may call out for the praise of God. So that's the little section on God revealing himself through nature. I think the most clear and powerful impression we get is some idea of wonder and worship, the idea that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And I like this quote from Francis Collins, who's was the head of the Human Genome Project, is now the head of the NIH, which is the big American funder of biomedical science. And he says this in his book, The Language of God. The work of a scientist in this project, particularly a scientist who has the joy of also being a Christian, is a work of discovery, which can also be a form of worship. As a scientist, one of the most exhilarating experiences to learn something that no human has understood before. If you have a chance to see the glory of creation matched with, something went wrong with my PowerPoint again. To see the chance of the glory of creation matched with worship, he says, scientists who do not have personal faith in God also undoubtedly experience the intricacy of it, the beauty of it. Let's really experience. Okay, so I'm sorry about this. My slides are kind of wonky. To have the joy, I'll get you the main quote I want to get. To have the joy of discovery mixed together with the joy of worship, that's this bit, is truly a powerful moment for a Christian who's also a scientist. So what Collins is pointing out is there's something exhilarating about discovering something new. And as a Christian, this is something that can also lend to worship, I think, can be a very powerful experience. And it's interesting when you think of Collins, when in his book, The Language of God, he talks about his own conversion from atheism to Christianity when he was in his late 20s. And he says that he was thinking about this for 1 or 2 years, and one day he was walking through the Virginia forest, and he comes across a frozen waterfall. And he says in his book, it was a beautiful afternoon, and suddenly the remarkable beauty of creation around me was so overwhelming, I felt I cannot resist this another moment. And he says he fell on his knees and had a conversion experience. Now, what's interesting about a frozen waterfall is that there's nothing miraculous about a frozen waterfall, nothing magical. You know, if water freezes, it freezes. Right? And Collins would have understood that himself. But there's still something about the beauty of it, and the question of why is it so beautiful, why is it so extraordinary, that I think very often calls out in many of us a sense of wonder and a sense of God. So, to go a little bit about this idea of God revealing himself in nature, how do we extract knowledge of God from nature? That's sometimes called natural theology, theology of nature, a complicated subject. Perhaps the most famous natural theologian is Archdeacon Deacon William Paley, who wrote a book, Natural Theology, or Evidences of the Existence and Attributes of the Deity, which is a very famous section where he talks about walking on a heath and finding a watch. He basically says if you find a watch on the heath, you would assume that it was made by somebody. There's an intricacy. There's something very intricate and as a contrivance, he would call it. And so the argument that Paley made that became a very popular one, particularly has been popular ever since, is the idea that look at how incredibly complicated something like a watch is. It must have been made by somebody. Look how incredibly complicated, for example, aspects of the human body are. They must have been made by someone. They're some kind of evidence of God, that there is a God. Right? This is the kind of argument that Paley is making. And to this day, I think it's very common. So I would say that my experience of talking to Christian lay people about science is very often they'll want to say, well, look at this particular thing we don't understand. Look how incredibly complicated it is. Must have been God who did this in one way or the other. But which I think in the back of their mind is this kind of watch-like analogy, that God is a watchmaker who intricately puts these things together. Darwin himself was very taken by Paley and said that he'd almost committed the book to memory. And if you read through his Origin of Species, you can see that in many ways it's a polemic against what he had held on to earlier with Paley's natural theology. And famously, Richard Dawkins wrote the book called The Blind Watchmaker, which was he was trying to argue against Paley. And so there's an interesting aspect to this kind of natural theology, which essentially Paley and Dawkins are both arguing is the following. A reasonable person should be able to look at the natural world and extract from it some kind of meaning. In Paley's idea, you extract from it the fact that there's a God who intricately put things together. In Dawkins' idea, you extract from it the fact that you can make these complicated things without needing a God through the process of evolution, and therefore God doesn't exist. But both of them are essentially making the same kinds of presuppositions, and both of them are making just simply different conclusions based on what they see in nature. Now, it's interesting to point out that even in Paley's, or not too long after Paley, there was quite a strong pushback to his particular type of natural theology, the idea that you should be able to look at nature as an unbiased way and extract meaning from it. So John Henry Newman, probably the most famous theologian, British theologian of the 19th century, said he said lots of not so nice things about people that held on to this kind of natural theology, but he said most famously, "I believe in design because I believe in God, not in God because I see design." And more famously in this 20th century, Karl Barth, who's a very famous great Protestant theologian, has a response to the Brunner wrote a book advocating for natural theology, and Barth wrote a reply with a single title, Nine, No. Okay. And he said, "I believe in Jesus Christ, God's Son, our Lord, in order to perceive and understand that God Almighty, the Father, is creator of heaven and earth. If I did not believe the former, I could not perceive and understand the latter." So what we see is these two great theological heavyweights giving some pretty strong pushback to this quite intuitive and still very popular idea of natural theology, the idea that anybody who's reasonable should be able to look at nature and extract reliable knowledge about God from it. And more recently, Alistair McGrath has tried to reinvigorate natural theology, and he's had made a project of that. And there's two books I recommend. One's called The Open Secrets, which is more theological, and then The Fine-Tuned Universe, where he tries to use that idea to look a little bit more at nature. So what is McGrath saying? So he says, "I believe the right approach to natural theology is deeply rooted in the Christian tradition, while at the same time well adapted to the cultural context. It should be understood as a way of seeing and appreciating nature that arises from within the Christian faith." So what Alistair is basically saying there is we're very heavily affected by our cultural background, by the biases, the things that affect us. And so therefore, there is no view from nowhere. Okay? You can't just sit there and look at nature and extract reliable knowledge from it. That doesn't mean that therefore suddenly nature is not something we can't understand. We can start from one, in fact, in general, you can start from two presuppositions if you look at the world. Either the assumption of a divine will and purpose behind this world, or the assumption of just pure materialism. And those are two starting assumptions. And depending on which one of those you take, you can then look at nature and ask yourself which of these two starting presuppositions, people like Plantinga and others would call properly basic assumptions. If you take one of these properly basic assumptions and you look at the world, which of the two makes the most sense of the natural world? In which of these two do you have the most resonance with the starting assumption that you have? And you can ask yourself, kind of then weave together, if you want, a tapestry of arguments that make more sense or less sense of the world, including the nature that we see. And that's a much healthier way of doing natural theology. So I just want to point out the difference between the kind of Paley-esque Enlightenment style natural theology, the idea that there is a view from nowhere. If you're clever enough, there is a, and this is the same point that someone like Dawkins and a lot of atheists would make, the same kind of presuppositions, kind of rationalistic presuppositions, that there is a view from nowhere. There is a rational, unbiased view that you can have. You can look at nature, and then you can interpret nature. And therefore, and what Alistair would be saying, and what actually Newman and Barth would be saying, is that's not true. If you assume that there is no God, and you look at nature, you're going to find the blind watchmaker. If you assume that there is a God and you look at nature, you might find contrivances in nature, but it depends on your presuppositions. And a much healthier way is to recognize that those presuppositions really matter, and then take that into account, and then look at nature, and then ask yourself which of these two makes the most sense of the world, which of the two is the more satisfying, gives the most satisfying natural theology, whether it's a materialist natural theology or a theistic natural theology. Those are the two options that you have. Let me just keep this thing up. Got the gaps coming. It's interesting. So you can ask, people often ask me, so what kind of arguments from science can you use if you are a McGrathian or a post-Barthian natural theologian? And then I would say, well, I think there's lots of things to be done by looking at questions like the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics, fine-tuning cosmology. And I was here not too long ago in Bristol. I gave a test of faith talk, in which I talked in a lot more detail about these kinds of questions. So I'll skip all that. And I'll go now to the main thing I wanted to point out, talk about today, or the main title of my talk, which is talking about evolution and metaphor. So I've told you something about self-assembly. I've told you something about the Bible, nature, and science, very, very briefly. I had a little diversion into natural theology because I think it's important to think about that first and to make sure we do a little ground-clearing exercise before we ask ourselves in more detail, can we now look at something like evolution? So my argument is going to be that that a lot of the difficulties that Christians have with evolution, they come in two camps. The most important difficulties are difficulties having to do with how people interpret Scripture, and there I should tell them they should read Ernst's book, and I think that should clear that up, so I'll skip all that. But the other, I think, equally important kind of under the surface issue has to do with metaphors. So I told you just briefly about this idea of nature being very large, the universe being very big, there being 100 billion stars in our galaxy and 100 billion galaxies in our universe. And for most Christians, that's something that seems wonderful. And so it's amazing that the universe is so big. There are good anthropic arguments why the universe needs to be that big in order for life to come into being, which is also interesting. But you can also ask yourself, what about the history of life on Earth? What about how old the Earth is? I think people often don't realize just how old the Earth really is. 4.6 billion years is a very, very long time. And life has been around for about 3.5 billion years, depending on how you count, 3 billion years, let's say. But animals have only been around for about 500 million years. And like ourselves, modern humans have been around for a very, very short time. If you were to think about it, the way I think about this is to say, let's say the Earth is 24 hours old, something like a day, then what would our life be? Our life would be the last milliseconds of that day. That's how short it is compared to the age of the Earth. So one kind of way of thinking about this is to say, well, okay, in space, we think the bigger space is really big, that somehow tells us something about the glory of God. Similarly, we can look into time, deep time, and say that also tells us something about the glory of God. It's not surprising that if space is very big, time should also be very big. It seems kind of not so clear. Nevertheless, this whole question of evolution is very difficult and emotional. I think the real reason it's difficult and emotional is because for many people, Christians and non-Christians, where we come from, so where we evolved from or where we came from, determines who we are and how we should live. I think for Christians, really, what should determine how we should live should be the Bible. That should be our basis for determining where we should come from, how we should live and who we are, our identity and our way we live. But for a lot of people, there's an idea that somehow if we came, if we evolved over, if our physical bodies came about through a process of evolution, then somehow that feels like it makes us less. I think that's a very common point of view. Both Christians and non-Christians, but I think it's not a view that certainly Christians could hold. But I don't think those kinds of meaning things can really be properly derived from them. I think part of the reason why, for many people, the idea of evolution is also difficult is because of natural theology, certain natural theology assumptions that they make when they look at the world, kind of a popular natural theology, and I talked about that already. And then there's questions of evolutionary metaphors. So metaphors are important, language is important, So 2 years ago was the International Darwin Year, 200 years after his birth, 150 years after the publication of The Origins of Species. And he wrote in the end of his book, there's a grandeur in this view of life with its several powers, having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one. And from so simple a beginning, endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are being evolved. So the point of this, I think, is to say, I like this little section a lot. I think there is something about the way that evolution makes things, that endless forms most beautiful are being evolved. So first, before I get on to that, another intermezzo, which is defining the word evolution, which I've been using quite loosely up to now. The problem with the word evolution, like many controversial words, is that it has many different meanings to many different people. And I'll give you a rough categorization, but you could split each of these things down into many, many more subcategories. So the first idea is evolution as natural history. The Earth is a few billion years old, and complex life forms follow from simpler life forms. So a long time ago we had only bacteria, and then we had little crawling things, and then, hello, behold, here we came with warm blood, and et cetera, et cetera. So that's evolution as natural history. There's also evolution as a mechanism for the emergence of biological complexity. So we see in the fossil record that things a long time ago were different than they are now, and the question is, why did they change? Why was there change over time? And then evolution is the mechanism for that. So there's mutations that generate variation, generate different things, and there's selection, and somehow that is what generates the complexity around us. Now, most Christians actually would agree that this is a process that God created. So, for example, your immune system, the reason why your immune system with a limited number of proteins can nevertheless recognize a very, very large number of different of antigens, pathogens, is because it uses a very rapid evolutionary mechanism to adapt to whatever's coming in. So right now as we speak, your immune system is fighting the viruses, self-assembling viruses, using an evolutionary mechanism in order to adapt. If it didn't have that evolutionary mechanism, then you would somehow your immune system would need an enormous number of proteins in order to be able to adapt, to be able to fight every single thing that comes along. And that system is essentially the same. It's a natural selection and variation in principle. There's, of course, important differences with in detail. So the question really is not, for Christians, is not does God use variation, natural selection, because he does. But we say he does. The question is that enough to explain the variation that we see through natural history? And that's an interesting, I think, scientific question. It's never been clear to me what the theological interest is in that question, but it is nevertheless the question that that particularly in, say, an intelligent design community is the dominant one that they worry about. I've never quite understood why they focus on that particular one. It seems to me that if you hold to a particular view of scripture that views Genesis as being essentially a journalistic narrative, then you have difficulty with natural history. It doesn't really matter how that natural history changed, but your problem is natural history. Whereas if you don't, then I don't really see why it matters so much. Now, I can see why that's a problem or a difficulty for people. I think it's a solvable one. But I don't really see why the evolution number two should be an issue, but it often is. And finally, there's the evolution as a big picture, or as a worldview, or something like all scientism. So famously, George Gaynard Simpson said, "Man is the result of a purposeless and materialistic process that did not have him in mind. He was not planned. He is a state of matter, a form of life, a sort of animal, and a species of the order primates, akin nearly or remotely to all of life and all that is material." So that's a theological statement if I've ever seen one. And Richard Dawkins is very famous for making the same kind of worldview picture out of evolution. Darwin has made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. So what happens, I think, in practice is that Christians rightly react to this worldview picture, this idea that somehow evolution is fraught with meaning, that evolution somehow tells us where we came from and who we should be, and they say, well, that's not true. And so I think probably the most healthy response would be to point out that that is an incorrect way of extracting meaning from the natural world. It's an incorrect natural theology that it could be Christian or secular or natural theology. Instead, what's happened is that we've built up a little bit of a a folk industry trying to undermine evolution itself, either in the natural history or else as a mechanism. And it's not entirely clear to me that that is. I think that's probably the wrong. That's the wrong approach. But that's where we are. So Christians have lots of different approaches to looking at emergent biological complexity, which I've already spoken about before. I'll skip these. I'll get to this question of metaphors and meaning. So the first question is this language of random. Okay, we have random mutations and natural selection. Jacques Monod, a very famous French Nobel Prize winning physicist, wrote a book on chance and necessity. And so one of the things that a lot of people say is, well, the difficulty of evolution is that it's random. Okay, it's random. Random means purposeless. Purposeless is bad. Evolution is bad. Okay, and that's a very common way of thinking about evolution. So I think if it was up to me, we would ban the use of the word random in evolution, because I think that's not really a helpful word. And so in science, we're used to that. And I would prefer to use a word which is more technical called the stochastic optimization. So when I put those self-assembling viruses together, they moved around in a random way, okay, but that eventually found the right positions. And in fact, there's a whole series of methods. You can essentially prove that if you're doing, say, an integral, so you're trying to calculate an integral, and as you add more and more dimensions to your integral, once your integral becomes high enough dimensions, some kind of random sampling methods, what we often call Monte Carlo methods, are much more efficient and effective than any kind of direct method. So if you do want to optimize in a high-dimensional space, then using some kind of stochastic algorithm is almost always the best way of doing this. Given that that's the case, it's not surprising that if God were to create through an evolutionary mechanism, that there would be a stochastic element to that. The important point is that when you do a Monte Carlo simulation, you generate random variation all the time. But you have some kind of selection operator that works, and if you combine the two together cleverly, you can solve a whole series of kinds of problems, including the problem both of the assembly of this thing and the design of the assembly. So these things are used to stop, they heavily affect your life. Your stock portfolio, if you have one, or if not, your interest rates, all these things are determined by these stochastic algorithms. This is what is used on the stock market. It's used to model the building of bridges, a rocket coming in to from space. Even there, they use a direct simulation Monte Carlo, so it's a Monte Carlo method, essentially. So that's a really important point. And if you think about it, back to the first image I gave you, so that's the first metaphor I want to talk about here, was the metaphor of random. And I'm going to say that word random has often been misused. And I think it's better to use the word stochastic, and then a lot of that value-laden rhetoric would disappear. In fact, if you think about it, if I look at my little Lego blocks and I say, I could give you a train that's been fully formed, that would be cool. But if I give you a box and I shake it and out comes a fully formed train, that would be even cooler, I think. And so one can imagine that if God could create by a method that creates rather than creating directly, both of those are within his power. And it seems to me that the second way, creating a mechanism that makes endless forms most beautiful, may even be more glorious. So that's the first little metaphor, random or stochastic, and the link to this, that metaphor of self-assembly. The second one I want to look at is a question of Lego blocks or clay. So there's a common kind of idea that the way evolution works is that it goes in any possible random direction. So you can go this way or you can go that way, and that what comes out is largely unstructured. But in fact, one of the interesting things that we've realized in the last few years is that there's a whole series of building blocks that nature uses that are more like Lego blocks than they are like clay or plasticine. So let me give you an example. There's a whole series of genes that are used everywhere in the animal kingdom. One of them is a gene called PAC6. When it was first discovered by Walter Gehring in Basel, he actually called it the master gene, partially because Nietzsche, I think, lived in Basel. It's now called PAC6. And it controls, for example, the development of eyes. And so what you see here, this is a fly, and if you put the PAC6 gene from a human into a fly, in the bit that makes wings, the fly makes a sadly not very well working fly eye onto its wing. So it's that same gene has been very. It's a Lego block. It's a toolkit gene that you can use to make things. There's a whole series of them. They have funny names like Sonic Hedgehog. One's called Shaven Baby. That's because it makes the hairs of the embryo fall off. One's called Tin Man, which is related to the heart. If you've ever seen The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, remember the Tin Man who didn't have a heart. So they have these kinds of amusing names. It's a really lovely book by Sean Carroll, who's an American biologist, called Ellis Runs the Beautiful, The New Science of Evo-Devo. So that's evolution and development. It's called Evo-Devo. In the making of the animal kingdom. If you like this kind of thing, I highly recommend it. So another kind of a metaphor to think about is, you know, is this being made of plasticine, could go in any possible direction, or is it actually that you're making it out of a certain number of blocks? Another question we can ask ourselves is, why are there so few genes? So when the Human Genome Project first came out, we expected there to be a lot more genes in humans than there are. Here I'll show you a few well-known organisms, E. coli and yeast, and these little two worms, C. elegans and P. pacificus, both have about 900 cells, but one of them should be 23,000, not 29,000. Roughly the same number of genes as human beings have. So one of the questions is, where does the complexity come from that we have? Why do we have so few genes? The Human Genome Project, before it ran, they expected it to be on the order of several hundred thousand, or 150,000 genes, but there's only about 23,000. Moreover, if we look at our genes, we share 50% of our genes with E. coli, 25% with yeast, 70% with frogs, although if you kiss them, apparently, they may think about frogs, and 98% with chimpanzees. So one of the questions then is, what makes us different? What makes us not like a chimpanzee? I have some personal interest in this. This is a picture of myself with my chimpanzee. My parents are biologists, so when I was young, we had the chimpanzee as a pet. And in case it's not clear to you, this is a chimpanzee and that's me. My mother says that although we looked, hopefully we looked differently, but we behaved apparently remarkably similar. So the question is, what makes us different? Well, one of the things that makes us different is not the genes that we have, but the way these genes are interconnected. So all these genes talk to each other, they turn each other on, turn each other off. And you can imagine that the complexity that you can generate by connecting these things is absolutely massive. I had a little movie on this. We talk about genes not as, but I think I don't have sound, so I'm going to skip it. I can send it to you later, or I can put it on the PowerPoint. It's a really little movie where this chap from Scientific American explains the difference between the old idea of genes as a blueprint and a more modern idea of genes as a set of switches that you can switch and make all kinds of cool things. So that's the question of genes. And if you go further on genes, Richard Dawkins has a famous piece in one of his books, Leaving the Rainbow, where he says, the individual organism is not fundamental to life, but something that emerges when genes, which at the beginning of evolution were separate warring entities, gang together in cooperative groups as selfish cooperators. The individual organism is not exactly an illusion, it is too concrete for that, but it is a secondary derived phenomenon cobbled together as a consequence of the actions of fundamentally separate, even warring, human warring agents. Which is, I think, a classic example of nothing but tree, which I'll skip for now. But I think it's a nice little story. What time is it, by the way? Somebody have the time?
It's 9:05.
9:05, okay, so I should probably start wrapping up. I had 45 minutes, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Good, so I want to wrap up with the last few slides. So that thing from Dawkins, basically saying we are nothing but cobbled together secondary elements of our genes, is a kind of what we might call nothing but tree. We are made of genes, we are nothing but genes. We are made of chemicals, we are nothing but bags of chemicals. It's a famous kind of fallacy. But you can take a step further and ask yourself, is that really true, that this gene-centric point of view is where we get our meaning from, or who we really are? Are we really simply secondary agents cobbled together from warring genes? So Dennis Noble, who's another very famous biologist in Oxford, in fact, was Richard Dawkins' thesis. He did the thesis exam for Richard. So Richard has a really interesting piece in The Selfish Gene, beautifully written. Genes swarm in huge colonies, safe inside gigantic lumbering robots, sealed off from the outside world, communicating with it by tortuous indirect routes, manipulating it by remote control. They are in you and me, they created us body and mind, and their preservation is the ultimate rationale for our existence. And so Dennis, in his book, The Music of Life, which is a book on systems biology, a kind of more top-down way of looking at biology, he said, What if I turn that around and say genes are trapped in huge colonies, locked inside highly intelligent beings, molded by the outside world, communicating with it by complex processes, to which blindly, as if by magic, function emerges. They're in you and me, we are the system that allows their code to be read, and their preservation is totally dependent on the joy that we experience in reproducing ourselves. We are the ultimate rationale for their existence. And he tells me that he put this to Richard and said, can you think of an experiment which would distinguish these two points of view? And he couldn't, because they're just two different ways of looking at the same data. And the reason I put that out is it's important to realize that these are interesting ways of thinking about the world, but extracting some kind of meaning from them is very difficult indeed. So the last example I want to give before I finish is looking at a question of contingency versus deep structures, or should you rerun the tape of evolution again? So famously, Stephen Jay Gould wrote a book called Wonderful Life. And in that book he said, if you were to rewind the tape of life back to the early, the Burgess Shale, which is a geological formation linked to the rise of early animals, and you run it again, you get something completely different. Nothing like human intelligence would grace the replay. The hero of the book, in fact, one of the heroes is Simon Corey Morris, a Cambridge paleontologist. Gould, in fact, said there's no Nobel Prize in paleontology, but if there was one, the first would go to Simon Corey Morris and his two colleagues, Briggs and Whittington. Briggs, who was here in Bristol for quite some time. Simon takes a very different view and says, when you examine the tapestry of evolution, you see the same patterns emerging over and over again. Gould, that the inverted tape of life is not a hypothesis happening all around us. And the result is well known to biologists, evolutionary convergence. The convergence is the rule, you can rerun the tape of life as often as you like, and the outcome will be much the same. Convergence means that life is not only predictable at the basic level, it also has a direction. Now, this is fun to think about. The problem is we don't have experiments, we can't do multiple experiments in rerunning the tape of life, so it's hard to know exactly who is right and who is wrong. But, I mean, there are some really striking examples of convergent evolution. So this is a simple example. A tuna fish and a mackerel shark, evolutionarily they diverged a long time ago, but if you look at the way they swim in remarkably similar ways. So this paper in Nature a few years ago, they put them into a little tank and they measured how their tails swim, and they showed the swimming behavior. Not surprising, because these animals need to swim very fast in the sea. They got similar, and so they solved the hydrodynamics in the same kind of way, so that's why they probably do that. But you have a lot more examples of convergent evolution, and examples of saber-toothed cats. One of my favorites is the camera eye. So the two most common eyes in nature are the camera eye, which is like our eye with a lens and a retina, and the compound eye, which a fly has, which has many multiple little lenses in it. And we share, for example, our eye with the eye of the shape of our eye with an octopus. Octopus also has a camera eye. But interestingly, the evolution origins of the two are very, very different. There are some fundamentally important differences. The octopus, for example, has its optic nerves on the back of the retina, whereas we have ours over the retina, which is why we have a blind spot, and an octopus doesn't. Okay? And if you actually look at the molecular origins of many of the cell of the proteins that are used, they have different origins. In our case, the developmental pathway by which an eye forms is very, very different from that of an octopus. And so we estimate that the eye evolved independently on the order of it, maybe at least 6, 7, or 8 times in different animals. And they're still the camera eye. It's not the same camera eye. You may ask yourself, why do we not get a compound eye? Well, this is roughly what a compound eye would look like if we had one, because it really doesn't work. So basically, we have only one choice, which is to generate a camera eye. And so this is an interesting kind of question. Why do we keep getting camera eyes that we share with the octopus? Why? Well, maybe there are only two possible main types of eyes, compound eyes and camera eyes, and somehow we always find them. Or maybe the pathway is constrained us that way. But there's something very interesting about the fact that these have convergently evolved. And the last example of convergence I want to give you is one of my favorites. These are anteaters. Anteaters are very strange animals. They have these long worm-like snouts that they stick into basically a pile of very, very aggressive animals. They have an incredibly long tongue, they suck these things out. They have a stomach like a cement mixer that just grinds these things down. And so they're very specialized animals. And here I show you a bunch of them. The giant pangolin, the anteater, the giant armadillo, and the spiny anteater. But this one lays eggs. And each one of these is evolutionarily, as far as we can tell, completely independent of the others. There are many other ways completely different. But they've all evolved the same properties, which is that they are anteaters. And so that brings us to a very kind of big question, and this is the main aim of Simon Cohen-Morse's book. The principal aim of this book is to show that the constraints of evolution, the victory of convergence, makes the emergence of something like ourselves a near inevitability. So that's what I wanted to summarize with a quick overview of a number of different metaphors, different ways of thinking about evolution. My main arguments were that some of the difficulties that Christians have with evolution have to do with issues under the surface. And those are things related to natural theology, ways people think they should extract value from nature, meaning from nature. And that's both for Christians and for non-Christians. There are lots of there's basically subconscious assumptions about that. And that when you actually look at evolution and look at it there's lots of interesting metaphors and metaphors are always metaphors, right? They always have limits. But it's really important that we don't get bogged down in one type of metaphor, like random, at the expense of other random metaphors, like say stochastic, or that we don't get bound down into a metaphor of evolution going in any possible direction, and that perhaps something like convergent evolution might be easier for Christians to interact with. So with that, I want to thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you very much. It's now 9:15. I'm hoping to get Ard onto a train in about half an hour. And so we've got 1/4 hour, basically, for questions and discussion. Rhoda, do you want to share? Okay, fine. So does anyone have any burning questions? Let's try and think of the most important questions that will the most helpful to other people. That you think of the question that everyone else is asking, and ask that one. Okay.
You've made many references to your science, and you made references to religion. Do you think that had you been born in a different society, let's say China, that you would have made pretty much the same comments in relation to the science, but very different ones in relation to the religion? And when I say born in China, I mean like Chinese ancestry. In other words, can you explain why in one case your comments would have been pretty much the same, which is a fair assumption, and in the other case they would have been different?
So I'm missing a little bit the point of your question, because clearly, if I have one set of religious ideas, I'll talk about things one way. If I believe a different religion, I'll have different religious arguments. I do think that people from multiple different religious backgrounds would or should, when they look at the science, say somewhat similar things about the power that it actually has to give us religious truth. That doesn't mean, I'm not trying to say that therefore religious truth is somehow a less valid way of knowing. I think it is a very valid way of knowing. There's many important rational aspects that are on the basis of religious belief. And I think different religious beliefs can be compared to each other, and they should be in a rational way. I just don't think that science, and last time I was here I gave a talk on the limits of science, where I was trying to talk about what science can and can't say. I don't think that science itself can do a lot to adjudicate one way or the other. It's actually one of the wonderful things about science, is that I can work with my Buddhist colleague, my Muslim colleague, and my Christian colleague, and my atheist colleague, and in fact my students fit that whole span, and we all more or less think the same thing about science. And one of the reasons we can do that is precisely because actually science doesn't impinge very much on these other important questions.
Does that answer your question?
I'm trying to explore. I mean, the basic question is, I suppose, in your view, why is religion geographically distributed and non-religion around the world? Is this an evolutionary process?
No, I don't think it is. In fact, so the distribution of religion around the world is very complex, and questions about secularization, non-secularization are highly contested, and so. There's a very large number of Christians in China, for example.
Well, yes.
And so these things spread around, and these things change with history.
As a scientist, do you find yourself at all uneasy about advocating the position of the anti-paley position. That's the one that you advocate, isn't it? The anti-paley.
No, so I don't advocate the anti-paley. So I would say I'm not anti-paley. I'm just pointing out that I'm using paley a little bit unfairly
to illustrate coming to something with pre.
Yeah. So what I'm illustrating is what paley, I think, was trying to do, and what a lot of his followers have done since, is to say, well, any reasonable person, right, any rational person, can look at these things and extract this kind of result from it. And so it's using an apologetic argument where you say, even though we have different religious presuppositions, we can all look at nature and extract something, and it should show us that God does exist. Okay. And so my argument would be that the problem with that is actually not a religious problem. The problem with that is this idea that there is this very clean, rational view from nowhere that we can just have and then look at something as if it were a clean slate. My argument would be we're always affected by a series of religious presuppositions that we have. When we extract meaning from nature, the great thing is that when we look at nature and ask ourselves by what mechanisms does it work, then we're much less affected by these presuppositions. And so I would say that for Christians, one of the reasons why Christians often think that therefore their faith should be able to be built up in the following way: you take a step back into this view from nowhere, and then you look at it, and then you decide on an evidentialist basis that this is what you should believe and not that. And the argument would be that that's not possible.
Does that make sense?
Not really. Because you're still means you're advocating coming to looking at natural selection with presuppositions, bringing suppositions to it.
So what I would say is that, we all bring presuppositions. So one of the presuppositions I bring to my science is the idea that the world is uniform. In other words, that if I do the experiment here today, it's the same as when I do it in Cambridge, right? That's a presupposition I bring, okay? And that presupposition is helpful for my science. What I'm saying is that when I try to extract meaning from something like natural selection, okay, what I'm arguing is that that's extremely difficult to do to decouple that from my other presuppositions. What I say is that the best I can do is to say, well, these are the presuppositions I have, not about the science, but about the way the world works. These meta ideas about my religious ideas, my big picture ideas in which the world works. And from those I look at, that's how I extract meaning from the science. It's different from saying what the things actually do. The question is, the natural theology one is, the problem is that you're trying to extract theology from nature. Right? And that's what I'm saying, is when you extract theology from nature, it depends very, very heavily on where you're coming from, what theology you're going to extract from nature.
Do you know much about sponges, by the way? But just
sponges,
on the science. Do you know about sponges? Is it very similar with the virus things that you're?
Do they self-assemble? You mean?
When you bung them through a sieve and then they reassemble. Are they? How far do they go down?
That's the question which I don't. But that's very interesting. Maybe very interesting to look at. There's lots of little critters that self-assemble in all kinds of amazing ways.
Okay,
see
that. Andrew?
As I understand your thesis, the Lego box was set up so when you shook it, you would get the trainer.
That's right.
Now, that seems to be more deism than theism to me, as if God set it up and then it just happened. So to what extent do you see God in his world now through the evolutionary process? And to what extent did he just set it so it would automatically happen?
That's okay. So I actually wrote, I've just got an essay up on Biologos, which is looking at exactly this question. I was asked exactly this question: does this not lead to deism? And that's a good question. So I don't think that it leads to deism, in the same way that we don't think that the fact that the planets move around the sun in a regular way leads to deism. We think that God sustains the world continuously. God sustaining the world continuously doesn't mean that he's interfering with it and fixing it. It means that if he were to stop sustaining it, it would stop existing. So I like to always give the kind of counterexample of Newton and Leibniz. So Newton famously, when he came up with the planetary system, he worked out the laws of gravity that explain Kepler's elliptical orbits. But of course, if you start thinking about it, the Earth makes elliptical orbit around the sun, so does Jupiter. But then Jupiter starts pulling on the Earth by gravity. And then if you do the calculations, it looks like the whole thing is unstable. So Newton said, therefore God must occasionally reform the planets. He sends a comet through or something and he reforms it. And Leibniz, his great adversary,
in a series of letters just before Leibniz died, took him to task, and he said, this necessitates a mean notion of the grace of God, basically. He said, because, get the right wording, this is a, okay, at this time of night, I'm wrong among the exact words, but essentially, Leibniz gave two critiques. One is that this demeans God's craftsmanship if he has to fix it later. And secondly, he said this is a bad view of how God acts in the world. Because when God does miraculous acts, in other words, when God does something, he does it for reasons of grace, so teleological reasons. And so there's a well-defined, there's a pretty well-developed theology of why miracles happen in the Old and New Testament, which are related to God's purposes. And so the question of whether God does miracles for wants of nature or wants of grace, that's actually Leibniz's word, wants of nature or grace, is an interesting one. And so you can take that same exact argument and apply it to this evolutionary argument. And neither of them would argue in favor of deism, I think. But the alternative is a robust theological way of God works in the world. So the idea would be that God, the customs of the creator, the ordinary ways that God sustains the world, could include the emergence of biological complexity. But that God can still work in the world, most importantly through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, in ways that I don't like to use the word violate, because that suggests there's some kind of ultimate law, in ways that are different from the customary ways. So I actually think the argument of deism, I've heard it many times, I understand where it's coming from, but I don't think it's...
Correct. So you don't see the... I have to use the word random mutations.
Yeah.
As in any way being directed.
Well, so here's the thing. It could be. Yeah. So God could do whatever he wants. God could have done many miracles in natural history. And by miracles, I mean he would do things in ways that don't are different from the way he normally sustains the world. Normally, the only way that we can know that a miracle happens is by some form of revelation. There may be an argument for trying to look at nature and using scientific methods to extract evidence for miracles, but there's no biblical guidance on how we should do that. So I'm not saying it's not possible at all; can't be possible. And there's lots of theories about how God, John Polkinghorne has theories about God using the inherent uncertainty in quantum mechanics to both have his purposes and not change the way he customarily sustains the world. It's all very interesting. It's fun and interesting to think about. I don't think it's, although it's interesting, I don't think it's fundamental to our Christian faith. I think there's a bunch of different models of God's action in the world that all are consistent with what the Bible tells us about how God acts.
Do you know the Francis Collins quote fully? Does he actually mention the waterfall is in three parts?
Does he mention what's right?
The frozen waterfall is in three parts.
It's possible. I can't remember the exact.
I'm sure that he.
He does.
And I mean, obviously, the Mickey tape on atheist websites is, if it was in five parts, he'd have said the five pillars of Islam.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so it would still be the God that he was thinking about, but he would have told him, he would have been told by the waterfall that it was Allah, not God.
Okay, I think we'll have to call it a day there. I'm really sorry to bring this to a close, We're going to whisk Ard away now to his train. But why don't you take the time to talk to your neighbour, the one you started the conversation with, ask them what they think about this all. Should God be guiding evolution for it to be from God? What do you think? Okay. So, let's we've got until 10 o'clock before we've got to be out. We're just getting Ard away now, though. Okay?
Okay, just say thank you. Go to this website that's actually set up by Francis Collins. You'll see that I currently have an essay on there, which touches on a lot of these topics.
Yeah, I'll circulate that.
Yeah.